Good morning. Can you hear me all right? I'm Jeremy. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here today. Breakfast. Gosh. Anybody a morning person? Yeah, I'm glad. I'm a morning person. I don't know what happened when I got sober, but I wake up at 5 o'clock without an alarm. I mean, I don't know if that's a gift, a blessing, but I am very much alive when I wake up and excited. Excited to be here today. Recovery is something I'm very passionate about. My sobriety date is August 17th, 2015. It's been a very quick 3.5 years of my life, and I hope to share, you know, my experience, strength, and hope today, what it was like, you know, what happened, how I got sober, and, you know, how I worked the steps. And that really is what's important today, is the recovery part. You know, I come to meetings. You know, I don't like to be in meetings where you just talk about your problems. I want to talk about the solution and how we get well, because that is the point. We can get well. But the reality is I was very sick, and there's things that happened in my life that led me to make choices that took me down a path. You know, that's really what happened to us all. The names and faces in the stories changed, but all of us had some journey that led us to a place. And for me, there were, you know, moments that shifted. I will say, you know, just on the front end, I feel like I'm a low bottom drunk. It really took me losing everything, what I thought was everything at the time. Really, it's what I put most important in my life then. But to start, I was born in Alabama. My parents were on vacation, and that's a joke. my dad took a job here in Georgia, but I've lived in Georgia my whole life. I feel kind of divided because my parents were divorced. I spent the first half of my life in Stone Mountain. I spent the second half in Roswell. But growing up in Stone Mountain, my parents divorced at an early age. I had step-parents come in the show pretty quickly. But my mom and stepdad drank. They drank daily. I remember being around that. And this is, you know, a time where you'd have a cup in the car and, you know, we're going to Tech games and they're tailgating on the way, if you know what I mean. And I know that as an adult now, the worst is when you pick up a cup you think you have and it's not sour apple juice, it's actually liquor. So I remember tasting alcohol at an early age and not really knowing. I mean, I didn't have an effect of it, but I didn't like the taste at least. But being around my parents, they drank every day. They're both corporate people. My stepdad worked at Southern Company for 43 years. He just retired, so he had the same job forever. My mom, a different story. My mom is in recovery today, but she was an active alcoholic in my childhood. She actually will celebrate 24 years in recovery this year. But there was a time in my life where that wasn't so, and mom drank every day. You know, at the time, I just thought slurring your words and falling down like she was tired. But I see now that my mom really had it bad. And she has her own story, and she was doing the best she could. But at the time, I grew up in a very what I felt was dysfunctional. I was a single child, even though I had step-siblings. I never lived with them in my childhood. My dad had remarried, and I had some siblings there. My stepdad had two daughters, but they didn't come. So I never really knew where I fit in. You know, it's like I have this family when I go there every other weekend, and then my sisters will come in, and like, you know, you look at everybody, and if they're married, you think they're the Brady Bunch or the Cosby Family or Family Ties or whatever the hell show you were watching. You know, but I just remember always looking out, wanting something I didn't have. And then every other weekend, I'm with my dad, and my dad, you know, he's a salesman. I'm probably where I get my salesmanship from, but he just kept planting the seed. When you come live with me one day, your life will be better than you ever imagined. You know, and he told me at an early age, if you can tick your mom off enough, she'll let you come live with me. And I mean, we joke about it, but like that's, you know, brainwashing is what I've kind of come to realize. But every Sunday he'd look at me and just say, I can't wait till you come live with me. And so I look at this now as like early on in my life, I was living for a future destination. You know, as alcoholics, we tend to always stay, we're future tripping. But as a child, you know, that was kind of pushed on me. I will own that today. But at the time, you know, I was like, man, that's all I thought about. I want to live with my dad. And so finally, in sixth grade, I'd locked myself out of the house. I was pretty much a latchkey child at the time. And came home, you know, at like 2 p.m. and my parents had gone until 6. So I had a lot of time to go do shit and get in trouble, all that. And I just came home one day and I was like, you know, enough is enough. And I ran a mile to a gas station and called my dad and said, come get me. Let's get this running away thing going and let me see if I can come live with you. Well, that, summer, my mom finally let me go live with my dad. And, I thought, you know, this is going to be the best thing ever. And so I moved in with my dad. My dad was remarried to my stepmom and I had siblings. And so it felt more normal. You know, I was going to school with my brother and sister and, it was fun. Sports has always been a huge part of my life. I grew up over here, you know, at the Roswell Rec. It was one of the greatest times. I'm in Little League, going to Little League World Series. I won a state title in football in the eighth grade for Georgia Pop Warner. I mean, life was happening. Church was a part of my life at that point. I joined a youth group. Those of you who've had, you know, religious experiences, that was something unique for me. I felt acceptance when I walked into church and youth group. You know, there were peers that I felt accepted me, and you know, honestly, kind of coming from living with two alcoholics, not doing much, to having this social life, for me, that was big. I really felt a shift in my life, and I was very social. I felt like I was the popular kid, but I do know that I was always the kid who could jump from every group. You know, I knew how to fit in each place. I knew how to be a chameleon. But at the time, you know, looking back, I still struggle with the fact that I was always comparing myself to people. You know, even though I was good at sports, I didn't always feel I was the best. You know, even before a tryout, the night before, I'm like analyzing everything I'm going to do for that tryout. I mean, I look back at this and that's, you know, I'm not going to say that's alcoholic thinking, but I definitely was a worrier. You know, that anxiety came on early. And nobody's putting that pressure on me but me. My dad was not like this over abrasive. Hell, I'd look up in the stands and he's talking to somebody. I just wanted him to pay attention to me. So, you know, I've been in my head early on in my life. You know, that whole obsession, and alcohol's not even entered that point other than I do believe being in an alcoholic home created some dysfunction and chaos. But as a teenager, you know, I was like any other teenager. I mean, I think in high school I went to this homecoming and there was alcohol there and I got drunk. I mean, I remember getting drunk and, you know, my dad wasn't a drinker. My stepmom wasn't. And, you know, being I'm one of those people I have to tell on myself, you know, like I just believe in the truth. And I told on myself and that was horrible. You know, I got grounded. But other than that, I really didn't drink a lot in high school. But I did, have a girlfriend. I remember, you know, getting a girlfriend. Girls were, a part of my life. I remember kind of chasing relationships, you know, and I know a counselor can tell you were looking for your mother's love. I don't know. I mean, we all just wanted something. And let's face it, women make you feel good. Okay. And especially when you get to keep one, for a little while. So I had this, high school sweetheart and, you know, our lives kind of became enmeshed. Her parents went through a divorce. And then right starting my senior year, my dad and stepmom, decided they were going to divorce. And man, that was hard. Like I had, you know, lived as a little kid with this childhood imagination of what a family was going to look like. Here I'm heading into my senior year and all of a sudden this is gone. I mean, that it's one thing to go through a divorce when you're a little kid and then now I got to do it again. And damn, that was hard. And my dad and stepmom had a kid together who's my half brother. And so their divorce was nasty and it really divided our family to the point where we'll talk today, but it just was never the same. And so my senior year, it was also around the time my dad was traveling. So I lived with my aunt over here in Town Lake. That's kind of how I got to know Woodstock. So I would commute from Town Lake to Roswell High School. And most of the nights I would probably stay at my girlfriend's house. Her mom had gone through her divorce. And, you know, that's just not very functional to me. When I look at my children today, I don't want my son, you know, basically moving out of the house, living with his girlfriend. But that's, you know, I had to kind of grow up quick in that sense. And I got through my senior year. And I'm not going to lie, you know, my dad, it's not like he was verbally abusive, but he never made me feel like I was smart. Both my parents went to Georgia Tech, even though they didn't graduate. They're very intelligent people. But I just didn't feel like I was smart. And so I didn't even know at the time until my counselor told me at the end of the year that I had over a 3.0. You know, the GPA just wasn't real important to me. I was more into sports and cared about that. But I actually made the Hope Scholarship. I was hopeless after a semester. I'll tell you about that later. But I wanted to play baseball. I tried to play baseball at a small school called Gordon College down near Barnesville. And that just didn't work out. I remember the disappointment. You know, I just didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I still kind of had a lot of pain of, you know, feeling very lost. The girl that I dated in high school broke up with me right before I went to college, you know, and then my family shattered. And I remember sitting there kind of freshman year and I was like, this feels very lonely. I mean, I felt very out of place. And it's one thing to feel uncomfortable in your own skin. It's another to be sitting there when everybody tells you you can do whatever you want with your life. Well, fuck that. You're lying. You know, I didn't know what was next. I didn't know what home was anymore. We didn't even live in the house, you know. Not that a house makes a home, but I just felt very estranged. And so, I decided after my freshman year to come back up here to Woodstock. And I lived with my aunt here in Town Lake and went to Georgia Highlands to try to transfer into KSU. And finally I made it into KSU, and that's when Johnny and I met. We were two freshmen at Kennesaw, and we met in the campus housing. And the best part about campus housing is it's close enough to the campus so you can drink and go to class. And we pledged a fraternity together. And I mean, we pretty rip-roared. I mean, I started drinking later, but I'm going to tell you, I didn't miss a beat. The moment that I picked up alcohol, I felt the more than the sense of ease and comfort. I didn't feel fear. You know, it's not that I was shy, but damn, I could say what I wanted to say. And I remember, you know, that effect that it had on me, and I liked it because I liked the way it made me feel, to feel invincible, that I could accomplish more in a social setting. I didn't have that timidness. I wasn't thinking about what everybody was saying. I just went on. And so we, you know, I started drinking, and it was not every night, but I mean, I'm living for the weekends. And I just thought that's what you did in college. But there came a point where other substances came into play. And for me, you know, that sort of sped up my alcoholism early, because when you mix other things, I know for me it was, I wanted to see how far gone I could get. I'll say that the most polite way. But if there was like, you could get messed up, I wanted to go, you know, not just to the moon. I want to go as far as the galaxy can take you. And that, you know, looking back, is pretty elusive, because I was addicted to the feeling of feeling good. I was addicted to that in relationships, the highs of getting in them. I was addicted to that looking, and I'll share my career path in a little bit. But that feeling, you know, I just wanted to feel good, and alcohol made me feel good. And then when you throw a little drugs in there, you know, I don't talk about outside issues, but I always described ecstasy as 365 days of happiness in 4 hours. But then, you know, 4 hours later, you want to hang yourself. I mean, God. It's horrible, but I, you know, alcohol's always been my number one. You know, there was a year in college that I experimented. I definitely smoked a lot of pot for a couple of years. I never really was a stoner, but I mean, if it was there, we would do it. And so, you know, about my second year in the Kennesaw, I literally almost failed out a semester. I mean, I was definitely pursuing partying more than I was pursuing education. And so there was crossroads, you know, my mom and stepdad were helping me in school, but I'm on my own at this time, you know, I'm living on my own and, still working, you know, while I'm going to school. And, you know, I just remember thinking, this is not working. Maybe I need a change. You know, maybe I need to get away from these fraternity guys. And, my dad had moved to Texas at the time, and I thought, well, maybe I should just move out there and I won't drink I did the geographic cure, even though it wasn't a cure. So I moved to Texas and I started a little job. My cousin owns a company out there and I started doing sales for him, and I was going to go to school. But the very first day I got there, my coworker said, hey, we're going out to a bar. Do you want to go? I was like, oh, okay. I want to fit in. And so we get there, and the moment that we're drinking, he hands me some pills and I'm off to the races. And so it only took me one day of my geographic change to start right where I was in Georgia. So that lasted about 6 months. I remember 9/11 hit, and you know, the world was uncertain at that point, and I was very uncertain. And so I decided to come back to Georgia. I was like, this is a mistake. All my friends are back there. I mean, I felt lonely, and I at least had, you know, fraternity brothers that cared about me, that were reaching out to me, even though I didn't know how to stop drinking and partying and all that. So I came back, and was living with a friend here in Woodstock. And Christmas of that year, I got one of the greatest gifts ever. I woke up at my parents' house, and I thought my car was stolen. I'll never forget this. You know, if you ever think your car's stolen, just call the police, and they'll tell you, Mr. Green, you need to call your loan company. They've repoed your car. And so I had financed a car and decided, you know, that partying was more important. And, you know, I was 21. Like, I'm looking at this now. I'm 40, and I'm like, how do you get a car repoed? I mean, like, how do you not pay your bill? I let my insurance lapse, too. And those of you who know what I do for a living, that's kind of funny because I sell that. And so I did that, and I remember my parents, you know, my mom is sober at the time, and she's like, we're going to bail you out of this, but after this one, we're done. Like, you need to grow up. And, you know, I was scared, like, literally scared. How am I going to do this? And I know I partied through New Year's, but a few weeks later, I walked into the Howe Place for the first time. It was January of 2002. I picked up a white chip as I think I was about 22 at the time. And I came in and I got sober in my 20s. And when I say I got sober, full disclaimer, I didn't work the steps. But I did get sober. I got some dry time. And early on in my recovery, I had reconnected with some people in the church world. And, you know, when I was younger, that was a big part of my life. When I was a teenager, it was nothing for me to get up and talk like this in front of people. And, you know, I went on mission trips. And I genuinely had a heart growing up to help people. And I thought, if I'm sober, why not go and do something and help people? And so, you know, church became a part of my life. And I was asked to be on staff, actually, at a church down the road from here. And so I started a career in full-time ministry. At the time I was sober, that first time, and, I had about 28 months of sobriety before I went on my honeymoon. And so I'd met somebody, I'd gotten married, I was in ministry, and I thought at the time, you know, I'm in ministry, I feel better, surely I'm, you know, I just drank like that because I was angry at my parents, you know, I've got a family now, it'll be different. I mean, don't we all tell ourselves that? I remember thinking that way. And so on my honeymoon, it was all inclusive, and I decided, hell, let's take advantage of this. I'm not paying for it. And so I started drinking, and I remember, like, it was great because if you've ever been on all inclusive, you just go get refills all the time. It's like Ryan's Buffet, but with alcohol. And so, you know, I picked right back up. I'm not going to say I picked up in the dysfunctional part of my life, but I picked up, like, my tolerance had not gone away. I could drink beer all day at the pool, hit liquor at night, and I was off to the races. Well, you can imagine the confliction inside of I'm doing student ministry, working with students, and I come back and there's this, am I going to drink? Am I not? Like, I'm already in the alcoholic mindset, even though I don't know it. And I drank closetly for 10 years in ministry. In some capacity, I've got this relationship of, you don't know I'm drinking, but I am. I'm not drinking at bars. I'm drinking at home. And I'm drinking because I have anxiety. And this quiets the voices. Okay? Not because I just think it's cool. I mean, for me, I self-medicated for a lot of years. And it, you know, that's exhausting keeping that up. I'm going to make a joke, but I would never put a church sticker on my car because I don't want you to see me when I pull up to the liquor store, you know. But I started in ministry, and I was able to drink functionally for a number of years. And I would have this pattern though where I would go and I'd be the youth pastor for 3 years and I'd grow it to a couple hundred and I'd get bored with that and somebody would recruit me. So I'd go and I'd grow it. And that was good for me because I like, you know, we as alcoholics, we like to start and run things and then not want to manage it. So we go start and run. And then when you give me all the details, I'm like, let's just go start something else. So I did that for like 10 years and I got recruited. I decided, to go to seminary. I wanted to go to seminary. I had to do that in order to get to the next level. And so, I went to seminary and I loved it. And I loved it because I've got an addiction to about everything. And if I can be addicted to knowledge, I can do it. And so, you know, and I wanted to feel smart. I'd only made a 3.0. I want to make a 4.0. And so I literally worked full time and did a 96-hour MDiv. And I drank a lot in seminary. I'm going to tell you that. There was a pub up in Kentucky. I mean, why not go to Kentucky in seminary? That's where the bourbon capital of the world is. And I never took tours of the distillery. I kind of regret that. I'm not going to lie. But I did, I drank and, you know, for me, it just felt normal. Like, I don't mean to take away anything from people, but for me, it was just a normal part. I had justified it for so long. It was the narrative of my life. And so I'm in seminary and I'm, you know, I'm with my buddies and we'll have some, but they never really knew how bad it was for me. You know, that this is something that I do all the time. They just thought I was hitting it hard on these long weekends we would take. My son was born in 2008 and then my daughter in 2011. And about the time Lila was born, I was asked to start a church. And if you don't know what that means, you get a group of people, you tell them, hey, we want to start a new church. And I got people, I was recruited to do it actually, and got a group of people and we did that. And man, I needed something to help me focus. And I was real ADD, so I got on some ADD medication about that time. And of course, you don't tell the doctor that you drink every night. So I got on a narcotic. Why not? He did say it leaves your system every night. So I was like, well, surely I won't be addicted to that. I never felt I was addicted to the ADD medication I took, but it definitely started my blackouts. I learned, you know, in detox, when you're taking this medication with speed in it and I'm drinking to come down in the evenings, that while my mind shut down, my body was still awake. And so I had some horrible blackouts about this time. The fear really set in. Like, you know, it was different being a youth pastor because, like, you have a boss. Like, I'm the guy. The whole vision, everything stands on me. I have employees. I got to get up every week, and I got to keep this thing going. I'm full of fear drinking, but yet I got to, like, give you a message of inspiration. And at the time, that just felt normal. You know, but I was drinking alcoholically at that time. I'm drinking every night and I kind of know there's a problem, but how do you be the local minister and walk into an AA meeting? That was always my tension. I don't know if I've ever said that publicly till just now, but that was the tension inside me. I'm going to be found out. You know, I felt so conflicted. It wasn't even the moral issue. Alcoholism is not a moral issue. It was not the moral thing for me. It was that you're going to find out and then I'm going to lose everything I've worked for. And, you know, unfortunately, that's the tension that I lived with for about 3 years. And when I couldn't live with that anymore, my alcoholic brain figured out how to turn this church plant over to somebody. So my church merged with another church and I took a severance. And the worst thing you can do for an alcoholic is give them a big check. And so, you know, I was so proud. I've got a big check. But you know what? At the time, I remember I was scared to death. But it was different than when I was scared to death as a 20-something who, like, lost his car. Like, I have a wife. I have kids. I've been in the same career for over a decade. I've pursued all this knowledge, this school. But I remember sitting with my counselor and I looked at her one day and I was like, how come I get everything I've ever wanted, but I can never accept it? Like, how come I've met every goal that I ever wanted to meet, but I feel like the loneliest person that walks on stage and the loneliest person that walks off? And that loneliness that the book talks about, you know, the despair, that dropping off, I was there. I just didn't know how to stop. And for me, you know, when I took that severance, it was the beginning of 2015, like, God, I sat in my basement watching Netflix for 6 months, drinking, and like getting online trying to find a job, but I was too good to go take an hourly job. I was too good to just go, you needed to give me a big package and then I'll bring what I have to offer. And so that lack of humility was still there, even though alcohol was kicking my ass. I remember, you know, kind of the beginning of the end there. I'm still taking my ADD medication, even though I'm not working, because I want the speed that I feel waking up in the morning, and then I want the alcohol to bring me down. So I was definitely concocting some things. But I never really knew that. Like, I wasn't smart enough to know that's what I'm doing. That's just kind of the pattern that was happening. But I made it through the summer, and then school started. And I woke up on a Sunday in August, about the time I got sober the day before. And I woke up, and my wife had taken the kids and left. And when I say left at the time, I just thought she was going to go away for a weekend and this is going to freak me out and I'm going to go get sober. No, she left, like gone. And I remember her saying she's leaving, and I called my best friend. I was like, look, Lori's left. I've got a problem with alcohol. I'm either going to kill myself or I need to get help. And it was that clear. Like, I'm either going to hang myself tonight or help me get help. And so they called Ridgeview, and Ridgeview had a spot for me. And I think it was a Monday, I drove myself to Ridgeview and went to detox for a week. And those of you who have people struggling with alcohol, when you've been drinking for a decade and you're shaking and stuff, like, there's safe places to go. I went because it was a desperate plea. But I remember going to Ridgeview. It was a great week, in the sense that I felt safe being around a bunch of crazy people, okay? There's always levels of crazy. Somebody's always crazier than you. Somebody's not as crazy, and you're trying to compare your crazy to theirs. But, you know, it was nice to sit down and be honest. I told this guy, like, this is what I do. And I'll never forget that doctor looking at me saying, do you think alcohol might be your God? And like, it was this defining moment that, like, I had made alcohol, you know, it was my God. It was my master, as the book says. And I just, you know, I was so disillusioned. I mean, my ego was so big, and I had the act going for so long, and I had directed it, that I had to fall off a really high mountain of Jeremy World. You know, but I remember going to detox. I got out and I went to a meeting. I thought when I got out, I was going to call my wife at the time and she was going to let me come back and we were just going to go back and all that, because she'd never threatened before. It never happened. She moved in with her parents. I moved in with my parents. And, you know, I just tried to find a job. At this point, I was like, okay, I got to bring some money in. My severance is out. So I got a job doing some exterminating. And, man, you want to talk about loneliness? I, am basically walking around houses all day, newly sober. I'm in a town. I don't know anybody. I'm living with my parents at age 37. I mean, I'm not talking self-pity here. I'm just losing my damn mind. Like, it's hard when you're newly sober and you're working any job where you're not around humans. You know, I'm talking to like bugs and spraying them and shit. I mean, it was hard. I know some of you had it worse, but, and, you know, because all I'm doing is sitting in my head all day in Jeremy World, trying to figure out how am I going to rescue and save my old life. And, man, this went on for like 6 months. And I was working the steps with a sponsor, but I literally did not know how to surrender at that point. I had the mental obsession to drink lifted, but the obsession to run my life and somehow fix all this was still there. And that meant I had no emotional sobriety. I had no peace and serenity. And right after Christmas, I realized, like, okay, I don't think Lori's ever coming back. And when that reality set in, it was less about getting her back and more about, I'm not going to get to see my kids the way I want to see my kids grow up. And when it hit me that what happened to me at that early age with the first divorce and then the second, I couldn't handle it. Like, I was suicidal in 6 months of recovery. And I remember thinking, if this is how it's going to be, I'd rather die. And, you know, a lot of self-pity in there, I'm not going to lie. I had the self-pity train really bad, and I really believed at the point that if I'm this horrible of a person and brought this much destruction on my family, maybe my kids are better off without me. And I really believed it. That's how sick I was in my mind, even with the, you know, not drinking. So a friend of mine recommended that I go to this place called No Longer Bound. It's a faith-based recovery place, and they really work on the condition of your heart. It's like a long 6 and 7. That works for a lot of people. It didn't really work for me. I still was resistant to change. I was still not ready to look at myself. I'll tell you what it did do. For 60 days I was there. You can't talk to your family. You can't call out on a phone. You can't do any of that. And I kind of needed that. They call it a blackout period. So for 60 days I didn't see my kids. I didn't talk to my parents. I didn't talk to anybody. And I'm around a bunch of guys, and of course I'm better than them because I've got a seminary degree, and y'all don't know. I mean, I was better than the director, and, you know, that whole ego trip. I still could not admit defeat with myself. I still felt I was in charge. And when I finally did get to see my kids, I got my divorce papers the same weekend. And I remember, you know, you want to talk about feeling powerless. I'm in rehab. I can't go fight this because I'm going to fight this divorce and get what I want. That's exactly how sick I was still. You know, I couldn't admit that I brought the destruction on. Let's just move forward. You know, but it was good because me getting those papers in there allowed me to process that in a place, and I couldn't text. You know, I'm not going to lie. Sometimes that phone can get us in trouble. And it was probably good that I couldn't send out what I wanted to say. You know what I mean? But I will tell you this. I got to see my kids 5 times in 5 months, and that was very humbling. Every Sunday I didn't see my kids. We went to this place called Fowler Park over there. And I remember seeing families with their kids and thinking, I never want to go through this experience again. I never want to not be around my children and be a part of their lives. And there was a lot of guilt that I had. I didn't put Avery in sports because it took away from my drinking time. You know, some of you figured out how to drink at sports. I was just too selfish to even sign him up. So when I got out of that rehab, I had given up my car. I had nothing. And my parents had basically said, hey, you're either going to finish the 12 months there or we're done. Well, being the good person I am, I left about 6 months in. And, you know, I came out and I actually like hitchhiked to a church that I grew up in, and they drove me to my aunt's house here in town. Like, my aunt's like my second mom, and I knew I could crash there. But you know what's cool? I came out with a different perspective. The first thing I did was came up to the Howe place, and this is in summer of 2016. And I came up here, and literally I got rides to meetings for the first 3 months, and I was almost a year sober. And again, I had worked the steps that first year, but I remember meeting Steve. Steve's my sponsor, been my sponsor since. We were in the parking lot, and I looked at him, and I basically told him the rundown of what was going on and where I was. And I remember saying, I want emotional sobriety. I don't want to just be sober. I want to live. And, you know, at the time, we started working the steps all over again. I literally reworked them, and I've got time to do this. I want to go through it because for me, this was the life-changing part. You see, Steve asked me a question, very simple question. What did God do for you today? You see, I had all this knowledge. I had all this self-taught stuff, but none of that made me whole. Every time I'd come to meetings, I'd jot down what you said, and I was just looking if I just had the magic statement. You know, that those of you pursuing the knowledge-based recovery, it doesn't work because there's no single phrase that keeps you sober. What I needed was an experience. The book talks about it in Appendix 2, a vital experience to bring about recovery. It's called the psychic change. I needed that. But what I needed was to get out of my head and experience God. And the only way you can do that is a day at a time. And so every day Steve would ask me that stupid question, what did God do for you today? Because I didn't want to talk to God. I was very bitter at God, and I was very bitter because God never did what I really wanted when I wanted. Actually, He did. But I was never grateful for the results. And so what I was lacking in my relationship with God was an experience. I could tell you about God all day. I was a professional God talker. But what I couldn't tell you is how He gave me a place to stay, and how I didn't miss meals, and how I have something to do with my time, and how I started to see my kids. You see, what Steve was doing was taking me back, and I boil my recovery down very simple, and I keep it simple for my sponsees. If your needs are being met, you're good. And yours and I's needs as humans are food and shelter. You see, that's the thing we take for granted. And the reason I say I'm a bottom of the barrel drunk is I couldn't provide those for myself. When you can't provide that for yourself and your higher powers meeting that need, you begin a new sense of gratitude. And for me, you know, I lived in a big house and had cars and had all that. And that never brought happiness. So now for somebody else to meet that, and I do believe God was meeting that need through people in this program. You know, Trey let me borrow his car to go get my kids on a Wednesday. I mean, there were little things. I got a job, you know, I'm in a career. But that simple question he'd ask you every day, what did God do for you today? And I'm like, let's go down the list, dummy. I never called him that. But what it did was, you know, in about 3 months, I was like, holy cow. I don't have a car, but I'm making meetings. I don't have a lot going on, but I just got a really cool offer to work at a job and own a business one day. I'm getting to hang out with my kids. By the way, I just got asked to help coach my kids' team. Like, stuff started coming together, but I was able to experience it because I'm mentally connected to myself. Steve and I did work a 4 and a 5 out at Lake Altoona. I love the place we did it, Steve, because I saw it the other day in the show Ozark. They were doing That Girl Blows Up a Boat. I think that was out there, right, where we were blowing up my life. And so I remember sitting on this bench out there with Steve, and, you know, I'm bawling my eyes out, but this time, like, I'm really ready to let it go. You know, more so than dump out where people had hurt me, I was willing to own the part that I had in the hurt. I was willing to accept that, you know, things happen in my life, but that doesn't have to define my life. I did things because of things that happened in my life, but what I did doesn't define who I am. And when we worked through that, it's not like I had a let it go moment there. You know, but I will say when we jumped right into 6 and 7, for me, I started reading Drop the Rock. It's probably the hardiest 99 pages I'd ever read, even in all of my seminary reading. Drop the Rock really changed. I've read it 3 or 4 times. It's a book I want to go through each year. Not because there's something magical in there, but it gets you to look at yourself. If you're not willing to look at the coping mechanisms, your character defects, the tools that you and I utilized in our sick phase of life to be healthy, you will bring your sickness into what could be health. And for me, I had a lot of behaviors and a lot of old thinking and a lot of old belief systems that still needed to be smashed. And I'm the analyzer and I'm the worker and I've dug, you know, I still dig. God wants to do surgery on your heart if you'll let Him. But you got to do the work to open it up and look at and put on the table with your sponsor or somebody what it is that isn't right. And I would tell on myself. I'm like, look, I just said this to her and this and that. And he's like, man, you're an idiot. And but you don't have to stay an idiot is the thing. But, you know, slowly but surely, and I'll jump to step 10 real quick, the pause came in. And I remember reading this prayer, God, remove the selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear that has cropped up in my life right now. See, sometimes we read these prayers and we don't read the words right. You know what I mean? It doesn't say, God, remove the selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear that's cropped up in my life next week. This prayer deals with now. You see, recovery is about living in the here and the now, and that's what I wanted. That's what I had missed my entire life. My whole childhood I spent, you know, living for the moment of when I'd live with Dad. Then, you know, as a teenager, I'm dreaming about having a family. Then I get my family, and I'm thinking about the next step. Today, I live my life very simply. It's in the now. I get to be with you in this room, here and now. I get to experience humanity now. And so, help me to discuss this with someone after I'm done bitching about it. It doesn't say that. Help me discuss it with someone immediately and make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone. And I love this. Help me to cease fighting anything and anyone. I needed to quit fighting with me. My biggest resentment, my second year of recovery, and it took me a while, was me. I could not let myself off the hook. I could not forgive myself because I just didn't know how to let it go. Because when I drop the rock, when I let it go, it means I don't have anything else stirring up the chaos. And let's face it, we're addicted to that chaos. When you have a day at work, I'd call Steve, "How was your day?" "Nothing happened today." He's like, "That's a great day." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" You know? And it's boring, Steve. "Nothing exciting happened today." He said, "Man, you're right where you ought to be." I didn't know how to live in that. You know, we're not used to feeling a sense of calm and peace that this program brings. But I was having more of those days than not. I will tell you for steps 8 and 9, because we worked on that. I believe in living amends. I mean, there's some amends you need to go make. You got to call that person, write that person, or you got to do that. But you know, amends doesn't stop, because if you've wreaked havoc in people's lives, you know, if you've wreaked havoc in or you've harmed people, we get to not harm people. You know, I remember the first time I came in early 2000, Danny B was here. And I remember he used to sit over here somewhere and he'd say, "Well, I didn't harm anybody today." I was like, "What the hell? Does he carry knives everywhere? What's he talking about?" I used to kind of in my mind like, is this dude nuts? You know, he is. I didn't understand in my 20s, but when I came in my 30s, I knew what he meant. I didn't spout out things in my mouth to cut people, is what he was talking about. And man, that was one of my good defects of character, is to cut you up because you're not going to get the best of me. You know, I've worked on that today. Just because I have a thought doesn't mean I have to say it. You know what I mean? I get to send emails to my sponsor before I send them to anybody else. If I feel my blood pressure coming up, I probably shouldn't hit send. I get to practice these principles in all my affairs. Step 11, meditation, practice that. I'm going to go ahead and tell you, I don't drop on my knees every day. Even when I was a preacher, I didn't drop on my knees every day. I don't have a problem with that, but I sure as hell can put on some running shoes and talk to God. And I can jump in a pool and swim some laps and talk to God. You know, for me, it's the experience. I sitting quietly and all that in my world is hard. But I can run down a road and I can see the trees and I can see cars drive by and people with their kids and dodge back into my head. And you know, I do meditate, and for me, meditation's about my inner self and God connecting and being one. And today, because of that, I'm more comfortable in my own skin than I ever have been. And it is all the steps. It is my recovery network, my sponsor. It's all that. But you know, that's the gift of recovery, that we can be comfortable. That's all I ever wanted. The little guy who I just was a kid in an adult body. And all I really needed was for the adult self to connect with the little kid and tell that little boy that was scared, "You're going to be okay." And a lot of that has happened through this process of working these steps. Is, and at the end of the day, isn't that what we want in recovery? You just want God to let you know, "You're going to be okay. I'm going to be okay." And that's the cool thing about this. And lastly, we'll carry the message to others. You know, I really believed in my story that I got into ministry to help people. I think a part of my ego took over when I found out I could get up in front of people and say things and make them laugh and all that. And then the roar of the crowd. But man, if that's not who you really are, I know the emptiness that it brings. Today, my life is a little more simple. I've got 4 guys I work with right now that I sponsor. And I got to tell you, being on the phone sometimes is more life change than when I got to speak to 500 people. You know, it's interesting how God will use you, and this isn't a church meeting, this is just part of my recovery, but you get to change the world. You don't have to do it in a church. It's not just in an AA meeting. You know, we take this program out into our lives. There's people in my office who want what I have, and they don't even know what it is. They don't, I mean, some of them know I'm in recovery, but they want the peace and serenity that I have, and I only have that because of the work that I've done. You know, when I get to take a guy through the steps, when I get to take somebody through the book, and I did lead the big book study last year for a year, and we went page by page. That was life-changing. You know, I will tell you, this book hasn't changed in 90 years. And millions of people have gotten sober. I can say that out loud, but there's people in here that have never read the book, and you may never pick it up. But when you're ready and you want to have a spiritual experience, there's words on these pages that will guide you through it. It's very simple. But you got to be willing, and you got to be honest, and there's got to be a leveling of the ego. And for me, that was the hardest part, was for my ego to be smashed. And when it did, I truly believe today that I get to be an amazing father, an amazing son, an amazing brother. You know, in the last few months, I've gotten to be a boyfriend again. That's fun. And, you know, I like my life today. I love my life. I love each and every day because the utter hell of that sickness that I lived in for so long, being uncomfortable for so long, when you finally get to the other side, you don't want to give that up. You know, I tell people who I got to go to a meeting every day. You know, I said this in a meeting last night. I was like, how many hours did you drink a night? Five? It's 1 hour, dude. You're replacing 1 hour for the five. Let's do the math here. I'll do it on paper if you need me to. You know, we think that's a lot. But this program is life-changing. And lastly, I'm thankful I get to be present in Avery and Lila's life. That to me was the part that just wrecked me, is that I was on a collision to miss my kids' lives. And today, you know, I look forward to every Wednesday at 4 o'clock when I get to check out of work and go pick them up from school. You know, for the last few years, I FaceTime my kids every morning, every night. You know, it's about being in the people's lives that matter to you. And you can be there, not just physically. You can be there mentally. You can be there emotionally. And this program is what offers that. So thank you for letting me share my story.